Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome back to New Books in African American Studies. I am your host, Adam McNeil. Today we have the opportunity to discuss the book, This Vast Southern Empire, Slaveholders at the Helm of American Foreign Policy, with its author, Matthew Karp, who is Assistant Professor of History at Princeton University. Welcome to the show, Dr. Karp.
Hey, thanks. Happy to be here, Adam.
Absolutely. And before we get into your book, would you be able to give us a brief description of really how you became and really kind of why you became a historian?
So it started with the College Dropout album back in the early 2000s. No, I'm just kidding. We were talking about Kanye before we started. In the news, always in the news. My journey was, it actually did begin not as a college dropout. It became as a college student more predictably. I was actually mostly interested not in the 19th century and not, frankly, at very first, I didn't think I was that interested in slavery. I wasn't not interested in it, but I was interested in U.S. foreign relations, foreign policy in the 20th century, the Cold War. My favorite undergraduate teacher, taught a series of classes on American foreign relations, the American Empire abroad and Europe and Asia and so on. And then as I sort of started thinking deeper about American history, I realized like a lot of them, some of the most interesting questions and the way that historians wrote about 20th century U.S. foreign policy, putting ideology, race, geostrategic, confrontation with the large international stakes. All of those kind of approaches weren't really present in 19th century American history. It was sort of from a foreign relations perspective, the United States in the 19th century was seen as, in some sense, off the main stage of European diplomacy and great power conflict, in the 19th century, wars and revolutions and so on. And I started thinking that this sort of was an opportunity, not that no one had written about 19th century foreign policy. Of course, decades worth of writing, but it was often written from an international perspective in a different sort of way. And when I sort of dug deeper into when I went to graduate school, thinking I would push this project, my graduate advisor, Steve Hahn and Stephanie McCurry, were really historians of slavery, historians of the South, and historians of African American history, and they. In their hands, it was impossible for me not to see that any history of American foreign relations in the 19th century, for all of the kind of international implications, which I think are really important, had to have slavery at the center. And yet historians in the sort of diplomatic historical, subfield often weren't writing that way. I mean, and I'm not trying to throw shade on diplomatic historians, but, the questions about American expansion, questions about trade and commerce, questions about, U.S. relationships with Latin America. I mean, these are all really important questions, the Pacific world. But often, slavery sometimes got bracketed in some of those conversations and, was acknowledged. But what seemed really missing to me was the centrality of not just the sort of the men running the State Department owned slaves, but that their most important, in some sense, their primary political belief was an investment in the preservation of the slave system.
Wow. And that's definitely an important reason why we're happy to have you on the show today, because, you know, just trying to open up people to areas like diplomatic history and American foreign relations. And I think a lot of times when people think about that, specifically like when it comes to African-American history, you know, a lot of people focus on Frederick Douglass later in his life and kind of those patronage positions to Haiti and what would then become DR, Dominican Republic as well. But, you know, obviously there's an important layer that's still there, because even though, you know, largely anyway, African-Americans were not enslaved and otherwise were not involved in American foreign policy for maybe obvious reasons, but their bodies really were very much the currency of American foreign policy. So we got the part about, you know, why you became a historian, but why this particular book, you know, this vast Southern Empire? Well, you know, why this book and why that particular title too? Because I love it, by the way.
Yeah, no, it's interesting. Well, so the title is another story that I can tell you that story, but just in terms of the book, yeah. So I was in grad school. I was thinking about slavery and foreign relations. But I, you know, there were a lot of different ways to tell that story. And at first, in some ways, I actually thought, you know, this might have been a more interesting book. I was thinking about telling the story, beginning the story with the slave rebellion in Louisiana in 1811, which is still the sort of, there have been a few recent treatments of it, but it's still, I think, a relatively under the radar for the, considering that in terms of numbers of enslaved people involved, it was the largest slave revolt in, you know, U.S. national history, you know, hundreds of people.
Dr. Carr,
in Louisiana. I actually don't have like the details of this in my finger right now, because I ended up moving away from that. But, you know, the idea was that, you know, in the aftermath of the Haitian Revolution, a lot of people, again, in grad school in this period, were starting to think about, I mean, certainly Haiti was really hot. I guess Haiti's still hot. But in 10, 15 years ago, a lot of the first kind of, not the first, but a wave of scholarship about Haiti in the aftermath of the Haitian Revolution was really breaking in early American history. And, you know, the argument was that in Louisiana, I felt like there was a possibility of thinking about this revolt in international terms as a kind of, an event that, you know, is only understandable if you think about a kind of international battle between slavery and freedom. It was happening in the Caribbean, it was happening in Latin America, and it was happening in the United States, and that a lot of these slaves were influenced by Creole planters fleeing Haiti and bringing their, you know, enslaved people with them. And then that, you know, I think the history of the revolt bears out that there was some influence there. I was thinking of starting it there, and I ended up not doing it just because there was, you know, too much happening in the later antebellum period, especially with these slaveholders. I never sort of found my way back there. But the book that was resulted was definitely, you know, shared that same fundamental conception of this idea of a kind of a global Cold War, sometimes a hot war between slavery and freedom, starting in the, you know, late 18th century with the American, Haitian and French revolutions, and that sort of unleashed the sort of the possibility of political struggles for freedom, for abolition, and made those struggles live, and they flickered on and off for the next 100 years, really. And, you know, it struck me that in the mid 19th century, with, again, there was a lot of scholarship coming out around this time too. I mean, I sort of, you know, said something earlier about, I hope I wasn't too harsh on diplomatic history, because actually, I was very influenced by a lot of the new scholarship on slavery that was really internationalizing the problem of slavery in the early 2000s. Ed Rogemer's book on the Caribbean emancipation, Gerald Horn's book on the United States and Brazil, the deepest South. There was, you know, these were more historians of slavery in some sense. But, you know, well, you know, Gerald Horn is a historian of foreign relations. Anyway, they were starting thinking about slavery in this international context. And for me, it just became clear that the strongest defender of slavery in this critical period in the mid 19th century, when slavery was actually growing, you know, it had weathered the kind of first wave of abolition, post-revolutionary abolition. It had weathered the threat posed by the Haitian Revolution in some sense. And in fact, you know, historians of the quote unquote second slavery will tell you that, you know, there were more enslaved people, enslaved goods, enslaved, you know, profits from slavery in 1860 than there had been in 1815 or 1830, you know, even after British abolition and even before British abolition. So And in this period, it became clear that the United States, not any of these other places, not Cuba, not Brazil, nowhere, but the United States was the sort of leading champion of slavery on this in this entire Atlantic world. And I needed to go deeper into thinking about who these slaveholders were that were running, you know, the American government on behalf of kind of international, what you could call the kind of pro-slavery international.
Right. And so as well, with that particular point, when you also look at other portions of your book that I thought were really so profound, when we look at the founding of the nation with what there's one particular number where a large majority of the American presidents from, you know, Washington on until Lincoln, the majority of them are, if not slaveholders, they're also people who are involved in some way with slavery. And so when I think about it, when I read that in your book and or other ways in your book and in other works as well, when I was getting ready for the interview, I was thinking, like, good grief, that's something I don't honestly always think about, but it just goes really to show, you know, slavery's importance to, you know, not only the formation of the nation, but, you know, the weathering, like you said, of the periods of abolition and how American foreign policy was always really thinking about that, as far as, you know, how to comport and contort itself to folks like the British or to these other nations who are beginning to free their enslaved people, while also realizing, like, hey, there's a financial component of this too.
Yeah, no. That, I mean, so yeah, the numbers are very stark. If you just, I mean, from, you know, from 1788, you know, from the to 1860 before the Civil War, I think the, you know, you had John Adams had a 4-year term from Massachusetts. You had John Quincy Adams for another 4 years, and then you had two Northern presidents in the 1850s who were in effect really sort of tools of the slave power, Pierce and Buchanan. And then you had 2 years of Millard Fillmore in there too. He goes in that category also. So that's 18 of the first, I'm just doing these numbers in my head. I should have this number. The first 72 years, you had 56 of them. The United States was governed, you know, the chief magistrate was a slaveholder. And really, it's really more like 66, because the only kind of truly non-slaveholding administrations were at the Adams administrations for just 4 years apiece. So, but in some sense, that doesn't even really, that's just the starting point, right? It goes so much deeper when you think about cabinets and you think about, you know, the War Department and in for my particular case, the War Department and the State Department. Du Bois has a pretty amazing calculation, which I haven't actually double checked his numbers, but Eric Foner told me, I was talking about this. He was like, you might want to check Du Bois' numbers on that. I was like, all right, well, we'll see. I'll just say Du Bois said it. If he was wrong, he could bear the blame. You know, 80 of 134, you know, American diplomats were slaveholders. Certainly, I mean, even if the numbers are off here by a small fraction, it's the proportion is still overwhelming given, you know, how most Americans were not from the North, not from the South, and most were not slaveholders. And so they really had this grip over the government. What my book does, though, is not, rather than, I actually don't want to flatten the early American Republic all the way to the Civil War, because I think there really was a profound turn in around the 1830s. Not that, you know, Washington and Jefferson weren't interested in the protection of slave property, because they absolutely were, and you can see this in Jefferson's reaction to the Haitian Revolution and so on. But I don't think, and not that they weren't interested in American expansion and the expansion of slavery to go along with it, because you can see that in the Louisiana Purchase, you can see that under Andrew Jackson, obviously in the Creek War, and then the Indian Wars of the 1830s and 40s. But I think from a kind of a strategic point of view, and from an ideological point of view, in terms of the international ambition of the project, it really shifted after British abolition, because that's when you, for the first time, you really had a peer world power, and actually a far more powerful world power that was now lined up against this fundamental institution of the United States. Before 1833, the U.S. didn't have to be the global champion of slavery because virtually every major European power already was doing that. You know, you had somebody like John Randolph saying, well, you know, okay, the Haitian Revolution is scary, but if they try to conquer Cuba and free the slaves in Cuba, Britain will snuff it out in the 1820s, because Britain was invested in, you know, its own slave societies in Jamaica and elsewhere in the Caribbean. So in a sense, the United States outside of the North American continent, the U.S. could kind of pass the buck on pro-slavery enforcement. After 1833, that's no longer the case. Just strategically, Britain is now invested in an anti-slavery foreign policy, which, you know, was more aggressive in some places than in others. But certainly, you know, when slave ships crash land, you know, when slave ships wrecked in Bermuda and other British islands, you know, the enslaved people were freed by the colonial authorities. So slavery doesn't exist on British soil anymore. And, you know, Mexico was like, huh, this cannot stand. And in fact, the United States is going to have to step up and kind of assume, you know, and this fits with the growth of American power and capacity over the course of the previous 50 years. But by the 1830s, by the 1840s, really when my book starts, the United States both has this sort of need, given British abolition, and the strategic capacity, the kind of weight to sort of develop a more aggressive pro-slavery foreign policy that wasn't just about the mere protection of slave property, but about, or even territorial expansion, but about something beyond that, about alliances with other slaveholder regimes, about a kind of naval force that could contend with British power at sea, and about a kind of a vision of the United States as a sort of hemispheric, if not a global power that was invested in slave property and in a future where slavery was at the center of the world economy.
And that is why, and something that I didn't mention to you offline was you talk about the 1830s and the 1840s and how, you know, that is a very, very pivotal time, especially in the post 1833, 1834 moment. And I always got to go back to Texas, right? I never lived in Texas, but where I used to work, I used to work at Fort Scott National Historic Site, which is the namesake of Winfield Scott. And so, you know, obviously Winfield Scott is an important U.S. Army general. I used to intern actually at Fort Scott National Historic Site in Fort Scott, Kansas. And so that is a space where its influence is literally only because of this of the Mexican American War, and the territorial expansion when you have what goes on in Texas and in Mexico's Texas, and then the Independent Republic of Texas, and then obviously when it is annexed to the United States. And so can you talk about that particular, how, you know, the figures in your book, how they thought of Texas? Because I think Texas is almost a metaphor in American public life today of, you know, it's like the Texas Rangers, it's the hat, it's the cowboys, it's the cattle, right? It's a very, you know, there's a particular aesthetic if you close your eyes. And it's also important with internationally, because a lot of times when people try to come from elsewhere outside of the United States to come in and visit in the United States, what I found out were a lot of people, you have companies, you have travel companies who want to go to the heartland. They want to go to, you know, quote unquote, the real America. And so Texas has a particular mystique that I think even in this time was being formulated largely in the minds of many of the figures in your book.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. There's the, you know, what's the sort of famous line about California, that it's like America, only more so. You can say that about Texas in a different register, right? From a different perspective, Texas is America, only more so. One thing, but what's interesting is I think in a lot of ways in the kind of contemporary incarnations of sort of Texas, you know, the Texas mystique, what's emphasized often is the sort of westernness of Texas. You know, you have George W. Bush at his ranch in Crawford. You have the Rangers, exactly. And so, you know, that's another story. And Texas is a obviously a site of Western history, a site of wars with the Comanche people and so on. And that's part of Texas history, absolutely. In a sense, what my book is doing is sort of recovering, not hardly the first one to do this, but from an international perspective, recovering the southernness of Texas. You know, the Texas is like America, but it's a particular kind of America. It was an independent slaveholding republic. I mean, its future, when it broke away from Mexico, the causes, Andrew Torgett has a book about this, about American immigrants to Texas in the 1830s. So I had old grad school friend, Sarah Rodriguez, has written about this. She's at Arkansas now. Her book's going to come out and be a banger about this. American immigrants moving to Texas, in effect, for a number of different reasons, but setting up a slave society in Mexico when Tejas was a province of Mexico. And the role of slavery in the Texas Revolution was significant. So from 1835 to 1845, when Texas exists as an independent state, I mean, in a lot of ways, its defining characteristic was that its entire economic, the premise of its future economic development, and even Jefferson knew about this way before Texas was an independent province, was an independent republic, was the idea of cotton, rice, and sugar were the possible growth of goods with the help of enslaved labor in Texas. That was how Texas was envisioning itself. It wasn't just, you know, rangers going off into the bush and kind of, you know, fighting Indians or outlaws. You know, the economic basis of Texas was slavery, especially in this early period. And, you know, so from the perspective of American slaveholders, Texas is a valuable and a vulnerable slaveholding ally in this period after British abolition, in this kind of uncertain zone in the heels of British abolition. Because you're right, it's 1833, 1834 is British emancipation, the acts are passed, and then Texas kind of achieves its independence, you know, wins its war with Mexico in 1835 too. And in this kind of uncertain zone, American slaveholders, they're eager to annex Texas. But my argument isn't, it's not just because they want that land, although they do. That's obviously there, and there's abundant evidence to prove it, and abundant literature on the subject. But they also want to preserve Texas slavery from Britain, from Mexico, from other forces in the region that are, you know, lined up against the expansion and the entrenchment of slavery. You know, there are British diplomats in Texas that American slaveholders fear are trying to negotiate with the Texas government. Okay, we'll recognize you and give you protection and kind of help the independent Republic of Texas flourish if you agree to sort of a gradual emancipation plan. I mean, that deal is basically on the table for Sam Houston and various other Texan officials. Now, it's not likely that they would have ever taken that deal. They were committed to slavery. They didn't really see an economic future outside of slavery. But they certainly flirted with the British. Sam Houston says something like, I coquetted with them a little bit in order to sort of, gain potential British support against Mexico, against this was a very weak, vulnerable republic. The United States, for people like John C. Calhoun, Abel Upshur, in the administration of John Tyler at this period, they're worried about Texas falling into the lap of the British, potentially being reconquered by Mexico, and the future of slavery on the North American continent, the Western Hemisphere, is at stake here. So the annexation of Texas is about American expansion, but it's also about slavery's preservation. And, there's a Texas guy in Washington, diplomat, who says something like, the slave interest in North America can only be safe if it is consolidated under one government. And I think there's something to that, it's nice to have another slaveholding regime, but we're going to be way stronger and we're going to have much more power to project slavery if Texas joins the American Republic. So most of the – Sam Houston was actually probably the most independent-minded of these Texans. Most of the rest of the Texas sort of political leadership class, you know, slaveholders, pro-slavery guys, they wanted in on the United States as quickly as possible. And that was achieved, you know, in 1844, 1845, and did, as you say, lead immediately to the Mexican-American War. But in a lot of senses, the annexation of Texas was, I think I say something like, the quintessential achievement of this foreign policy of slavery. It's a moment where, in the absence of a kind of this aggressive pro-slavery analysis of a Cold War between slavery and freedom, I think it is questionable whether the United States would have annexed Texas. I mean, you know, the truth is Andrew Jackson wasn't gung-ho about bringing Texas into the Republic in 1835. I mean, this is a question that I've been asked. Why does it take until 1845? Was Andrew Jackson, you know, not committed enough to slavery? I don't think that's it. But I think it required the much more aggressive pro-slavery geopolitical analysis of guys like Calhoun, Upshur, and Tyler, who were willing to risk the political, the domestic political blowback from Northerners and Whigs who didn't want any part of Texas, and were willing to had a sense of an international future in which slavery, the protection of slavery, was not just part of the American project, but at the core of the American project. And I think that is one way in which Tyler, Calhoun, Upshur outdid even Andrew Jackson on that front.
Right. And I also think about your comments about John Tyler made me think about back in grade school. And then this probably happened to you too, where you have like a civics test, right? Or you have American history test where you're tested on all the American presidents up to a particular point. So, you know, a hollow point being President Lincoln, right? And so it made me think, like, your book actually made me think about who are the presidents once we leave, like, Monroe, right? What are the ones, you know, I bring that point up because John Tyler, I think, is one of the more forgotten presidents, but he was one of the more interesting and intriguing figures in your entire book, not necessarily because of the entirety of what he did, but it's more so to the point that his importance is so much there, but how we acknowledge him in the pantheon of presidents is very minuscule, but he's very much important and very present to how we are presently constituted as a country. Because, you know, that's what I'm saying. So thank you for bringing back old lessons from grade school.
Yeah. Wait, do you remember which one you had to do?
Let's see. I remember, it was typically to the Civil War. It was typically to the Civil War that we had to do. And I remember it was AP U.S. History AP American Government, U.S. Government in high school in 2009, 2010 in Winter Park, Florida, Winter Park High School. There you go. Shouts out. And I remember I was like that guy. Everybody knew, like, smart guy, Adam McNeil. But boy, so when I tell you, they did not like me after that because we had a team, right? And so we had to be like, all right, so my team, they put me in. It was like a debate, right? And so you're going up against the other part of the class. Right. And everybody was like, Adam. But for some odd reason, I went cold after I went cold. I choked. I choked like the Raptors did in game one. So I choked.
It happens to the best of
I
us.
Missed 11 straight shots, and I remember that. And that was almost 10 years ago, but I remember it as clear as day.
You went, I'll show my age. You went John Starks in Eastern Conference Finals back in the 90s.
Yes.
You hit nothing but iron.
Yeah. Yep. My family's all from New York and they're Knicks fans. And so they still remember that. brief aside, of course. But I think all of this brings up, you know, even in a playful manner, you know, how important the annexation of Texas
right.
and that whole process is, because as well, what it does, it kind of internationalizes the minds of many of the Americans who went in and actually fought in that war, because, you know, a lot of times people saw themselves as, you know, citizens of their individual states and not necessarily in a collective American consciousness, but in the in the Mexican-American War, at least from my, you know, cursory understanding of the conflict, you started to see, you know, people going down to Veracruz in Mexico, going down into, you know, other areas of Mexico, and it internationalized them in the sense of they are fighting on behalf of the country.
Go ahead.
Yep. No. And that was the last part. But that, you know, that your book and this process made me go back in my thoughts about, you know, the conscience of what an American is.
Yeah, that's a really interesting point. I'll come back. It was just as quickly on John Tyler. It's funny. Right. I mean, the best biography of him is by Ed Crapold. It's called The Accidental President. It doesn't have any other, it's not buttering him up in any way. I mean, he's most famous for being the, you know, the first president who wasn't elected. He came into office when William Henry Harrison, you know, spoke too long on a cold day and got pneumonia and crapped out after, you know, a handful of days in office. And Tyler came. But I think the accidental aspect of Tyler's presidency is sort of, I mean, it is a contingent moment, but it's an important moment in American history because, I think in the space certainly between, Jackson and Lincoln in that, 30-year window, I think it's arguable that there was no president who was more influential than Tyler. Some people would point to Polk. I mean, this is the Mexican-American War, but you don't get the Mexican-American War without the annexation of Texas. And that's Tyler's baby. You know, he insisted on that kind of against, the received wisdom of both established parties. Tyler's, commitment to slavery, in effect, I think. I mean, it was a nationalist commitment. I don't think he was actually a sectionalist. This ties into your Mexican War point. I mean, this is a recurring theme in the book, that these Southerners who were sort of wielding American foreign policy, to acquire Texas, say, or to conduct a war against Mexico in the Polk administration, they really didn't, including, I think, to a significant extent, even John C. Calhoun in the early 1840s did not see themselves as sectionalists in any kind of candid way. They understood themselves, definitely the case for John Tyler, as nationalists. I mean, slavery and American nationalism were not opposed terms. It wasn't like if you supported slavery, you had to be a sectionalist as a Southerner. Slavery was national and slavery was international. And the default assumption for somebody like, for Tyler's Secretary of the Navy, say, Abel Upshur, who then moved on to Secretary of State and conducted this treaty, wrote the first Texas Annexation Treaty, was that, enhancing the power of the United States, whether it's through building a stronger Navy or whether it's annexing Texas, would only enhance the power of slavery. It's like that the Texan I was talking about earlier, that the slave interest is enhanced with a consolidation of national power. And so when Tyler annexed Texas, I mean, he set in motion a whole series of events, certainly leading it. I think it virtually made the Mexican-American War inevitable. Obviously, Polk, following in that tradition, in some ways he wasn't quite as an extreme pro-slavery man as Tyler. He was more of a national Democrat in the Jackson vein. But, he certainly wanted to protect slavery and preserve the achievement of Texas annexation. And the Mexican-American War, it's interesting what you said about that. That is another sort of theme in the book. Often that war is treated, for historians of the Civil War era, the Mexican-American War, you can't read, Jim McPherson's book on, Battle Cry of Freedom, or the big George Herring book, The History of American Foreign Relations, From Colony to Superpower, all sorts of giant surveys of U.S. history in this period. The Mexican-American War functions as a kind of ominous warning about the sectional crisis ahead. You're acquiring all this land, and it's that territory that ultimately is going to provoke the North and the South to fall out over the extension of slavery. And obviously, there's a lot of truth to that. But in the moment, this was not a sectional conflict. I mean, the largely Southern leaders and generals, including Winfield Scott, who executed and sort of commanded both the diplomacy leading up to the war and then the war itself and the treaty following the war, they were disproportionately Southern. They were disproportionately slaveholding. But they saw themselves as Americans. And I think the conquest of Northern Mexico was the conquest of California, New Mexico, etc. And then the negotiation of peace with Mexico was, enhancing the slavery interest and enhancing American power were not opposing goals. They were compatible. And by making the United States a truly intercontinental empire with interests, not just in the Atlantic world, but in the Pacific world, through California, slaveholders saw that as sort of enhancing the power of slavery, globally.
Right. And something that also made, you know, that also really conjured up some thoughts to me is that when we think about what's also going on, you know, a point to revert back a brief second when we talked about a British abolition, right? Because I think something that's starting to really be written about a lot, especially in the context of what's happening in the Windrush debate right now, which is happening presently in Britain, about the citizenship of those of the Commonwealth nations, right, who left in the 1950s, 1960s. What made me think about this was that even in the context of British abolition, imperialism was something where, you know, racism and imperialism were very, or racism, imperialism, colonialism are all really intertwined, and kind of how the United States is looking at the British, looking at what they're doing elsewhere in the world, so looking to India, looking to Australia, looking to really the Pacific Islands as well, and other places within the British Empire, and how American slaveholders are even looking and linking kind of their perceptions of their what they're doing. So I don't know if that's fluent, I guess, in what I'm trying to say, but
no, I think I understand what you're talking about. I mean, just the international stakes of this conflict, right? Is, I mean, I think the way in which slavery and empire were overlapping forces in, I mean, it's complicated. I mean, you think about the British case. I mean, I think actually a lot of the writing, the historical literature on this question has really emphasized, and not wrongly, the relationship between anti-slavery and empire, right? And the way in which the British Empire, sort of after 1833, there's a good book by Richard Hussey about this that's more recent, but this tradition goes back a long way, that the British Empire abolishes sort of specific, you know, chattel slavery in the West Indies in the 1830s. But in a sense, in for the rest of the 19th century, Britain mobilizes anti-slavery sentiment and the kind of anti-slavery justifications often to sort of conduct other imperial policy in, say, in, you know, most prominently in Africa, when, you know, in the 1870s, you know, the British penetration of West Africa and, you know, what would become much of British West Africa was justified by the need to sort of abolish slavery, you know, African slavery in Africa. And so, you know, it can get weaponized, as it also becomes used, you know, David Brian Davis sort of, you know, argued this, that, you know, anti-slavery gets weaponized in effect to defend industrial capitalism. Other people have argued it gets weaponized to defend the British Empire writ large, that, okay, we're an anti-slavery power. You know, in a sense, Chris Brown's book makes this point to some extent, as in the earlier period, we're an anti-slavery power, and that justifies that we, you know, we can maintain our empire in India or, you know, in the rest of Asia and then later in Africa, because, you know, what distinguishes us are sort of the fig leaf of our moral integrity, in some sense, is our opposition to slavery. And that's all, you know, powerful scholarship that's really important. But what's really interesting in this period in the Atlantic world is that that kind of anti-slavery imperialism of Great Britain. So I'm not trying to write Britain a kind of a blank check here in terms of what the British Empire is up to in the mid-19th century. But the truth is that in the Western Hemisphere, you know, British anti-slavery did matter. And it did kind of, it counted a lot both for these slaveholders who, you know, were trying to respond to it, but it also did count a lot for enslaved people who really did see, you know, and Gerald Horne and others have written about this, who really did see, you know, Britain as a potential and in some cases an actual ally in a kind of larger transnational struggle against slavery. Certainly, you know, against the slave trade. You know, the British Navy was instrumental in kind of cracking down on the slave trade and kind of pushing Brazil, say, in the 1840s, to accept a reduction and an elimination in a sense of the slave trade. Now there were plenty of cracks in that curtain. You know, plenty of enslaved people were still being shipped across, especially to Cuba in the 1850s and even in the 60s. But nevertheless, this was a real live struggle that really counted. And just because anti-slavery gets used as a fig leaf to justify empire elsewhere, the truth is there was a collision between anti-slavery imperialism of Great Britain and the pro-slavery imperialism of the United States. And that collision had momentous consequences, not just for places like Texas and California, but for, you know, places like Brazil and Cuba.
Exactly. And something I remember, I think it was Senator Ted Cruz in the previous presidential election talked about how America does not pick winners and losers, you know, when it comes to, you know, who's quote unquote wins in America and in the world. But then I also thought like that can't be true, because when you look at, you know, the United States when it comes to imperialism, right, and territorial expansion, not only in continental North America, but right, when you have slaveholders as at the helm of American foreign policy, many of the figures that you talk about, which I thought was so enlightening, was that they are trying to, and I wrote a little bit about this in my thesis too, where you have folks at the helm of American foreign policy who are trying to expand slavery into, you know, or not necessarily expand slavery, but take over territory to expand American slavery centrally. And so I thought like, wow, that, you know, so when you look at, you know, areas of South America, Central America as well. And so, you know, that to me was something that was profound, especially when you look at someone like Jefferson Davis, where it's almost like when we look at towards the Confederacy later, the people who got taught really what a foreign policy really was in the Confederacy, you know, specifically when they're trying to look towards like Britain and France, they were taught by, you know, the United States. So really it was like a training school, right, to kind of flip, you know, Ulrich Phillips's thoughts about slavery on its head briefly. It was a training school for American or for Confederate folks just in general, because when you look at Jefferson Davis, right, what is he doing? He's expanding correct me if I'm wrong, I think it was him who attempted to and was successful in expanding U.S. Navy.
U.S. Army.
There you go. And so, you know, that was something that was profound to me. It was, I thought like, man, this is something that when we think about states' rights, you, at least in my mind, automatically conjures the thought of conservatism. But conservatism, not necessarily, because, you know, you're trying to expand something nationally, right? That's the antithesis of conservatism.
Well, yeah, you know, that's really interesting. You know, I toyed with that question of conservatism. Actually, I remember I kind of got in an argument with Stephanie McCurry in grad school, where I was sort of saying like, well, how conservative are they if, you know, actually what they're attempting to do, because the book argues that, you know, slaveholders are making, both with their foreign and military policies, but in their writing and thinking about the future of the world, they're making a daring leap into modernity, that they have a kind of pro-slavery progressive ideology. And she ended up sort of convincing me that it probably wasn't worthwhile to like stake my book on an interpretation, a kind of a murky interpretation of what conservative is, because it can mean a lot of things. And to be honest, that's not my, you know, that kind of, you know, political theory isn't my forte. But what's significant though, in what you said, say is that certainly they weren't small government, you know, sort of laissez-faire states' rights conservatives in that respect. They were definitely big government conservatives when it came to foreign policy. They, you know, they combined, I think they did genuinely, again, because you know, for reasons that had to do with slavery, these slaveholders like Davis genuinely opposed the expansion of the federal government in domestic policy. Calhoun and Davis adamant about, you know, in opposition to, you know, federal spending, you know, that would imply a kind of the federal government's role, infringement of state rights in terms of internal improvements, in terms of, you know, infrastructure, in terms of any kind of, you know, the effort to set up a Department of Agriculture, any kind of domestic spending. You know, and the conventional interpretation, which is right, I think, is that, you know, that kind of expansion of federal power could potentially undermine the slaveholding control of state governments, which were, you know, what made slavery legal. You know, slavery was not official. I mean, they argued it was in the Constitution, but their last line of resort was the state governments. And then also this, just the slaveholders' direct control over the property of, you know, their, you know, the enslaved people under them. So that in a sense that an expanded, empowered federal government domestically could interfere in a kind of indirect way, ultimately, with, you know, slaveholders' control over their slaves. And that's right. And so that did inform their kind of small government conservatism. But that only goes so far as domestic policy. When it came to foreign policy, They were very aggressive about wanting to enhance national power, about wanting to expand the government, about expand the army, expand the navy. They passed all sorts of civil service, foreign service reform. They wanted to buff up the diplomatic corps because it wasn't just about fighting wars. It was about expanding American influence internationally. And yeah, Davis was an important figure in this. And in that sense, he was not kind of back. I mean, this is another thing. Like, is it conservative to be backward looking, forward looking? I mean, these slaveholders were not just looking back to a kind of bygone age that they wanted to protect themselves from the onslaught of modernity. They saw the world was changing and they were changing along with it. Slavery was adapting and transforming itself to suit the evolutions of the modern world, the rise of industrial capitalism, while slavery, slave societies were producing more cotton than ever to fit the British and Northern textile factories. You have mass consumer culture. Well, then we're going to bump up our production of coffee and sugar. We're going to bring railroads into the South, into Cuba, into Brazil. We're gonna mechanize, sugar plantations. If you look at some of these photos of sugar plantations in Cuba in the 1850s, I mean, they look almost futuristic. It's incredible the level of technological ingenuity that was going into, making these slave plantations function. There were railroads in Cuba before there were railroads in Spain. This is the argument of people who study the second slavery that, that this kind of mid-19th century modern industrializing capitalism wasn't, beyond even the United States, wasn't incompatible with slavery. In fact, it was very compatible with this slaveholding regime to an extent that it allowed them to expand their production and to sort of fit this new demand for these slave produced goods. Now, in the long run, was there going to be a collision between slavery and capitalism? I actually think there was. So in that sense, I'm sort of old school. But in the short term, in the 1840s and 1850s, from a slaveholding perspective, no, these two things were very compatible and slaveholders could eagerly embrace global capitalism and an expanded state power internationally to advance the interests of slavery.
Wow. All important points. Going a little bit further in the chronology of the book too, one of the things that I thought was, very profound in the book was about how the birth of the Confederacy comes about in the waning moments really of the 1850s and 1860s. Looking at how, because I think one of the interesting things about it is you still have people who are involved in government towards the end of, the 1850s going into the year 1860. And when obviously President Lincoln is elected, all hell breaks loose, or I would have said another word, but, try not to use that on these airways. Thinking about how influential the folks in power were, who were either slaveholders or very much connected to slaveholding in general, at least financially, I always think about how intriguing it is when they effectively remove themselves from the American central government to found something else. Yeah. And kind of like maybe this might be too highfalutin, but kind of like the brain power and the brain trust that leaves as well. And obviously it's replaced by others, like Secretary Wars and other things, but kind of like what that does to really not only found the new nation of the Confederacy, but also kind of how they had used particular ideology while in the United States government that they try to contort within the newfound Confederacy that doesn't necessarily, align with their prior thoughts, especially within the foreign policy lens as well.
Yeah, no, that's fascinating. I like that metaphor. I like the idea of like removing a brain trust. I think that's pretty much a distillation, a really nice distillation of my argument about secession. These guys, I mean, for one, just thinking, just on the ground when Lincoln is elected in 1860 and the Republican Party has triumphed and has kind of seized, the executive branch of the government. They realize they're facing an opponent that is different in a fundamental way from every other American political party that has taken power. I mean, you had Democrats, like Jackson or like Pierce or Buchanan. You had Whigs like Pope, like Tyler or Fillmore, and slaveholders were involved in all of that, and at the center of it. You know, increasingly, it's true that the Democratic Party became the home in the antebellum years of the most aggressive pro-slavery forces, but there were always pro-slavery Whigs who were participating in this effort. But with the Republican Party, you don't have that. They're completely frozen out. It's an entirely northern party, and the whole raison d'être, the whole reason for being. You get a taste of my bad French there. I should stay away from those words. The whole reason for the Republican Party's existence was the opposition to slavery's expansion. So they can't be bargained with. They can't be like, oh, maybe you'll appoint one of us to be your Secretary of State. That's not going to happen. There's no future for the foreign policy of slavery in the Union at this point. So the question becomes, what are we going to do about it? And what's remarkable is, I think because it is a brain trust of nationalist figures, is that even then, someone like Jefferson Davis is not leading the charge to secede. He still thinks, well, let's at least negotiate with these new anti-slavery leaders, and maybe we can actually sort of push them a little bit to retain a kind of a foothold in this national government, because they really are attached, as you put it so well. They really are attached to their position of power at the upper echelons of the state. And it's only the people at the state level, it's the more the state level politicians who are more rabid for secession, who haven't really been running the government, the fire eaters, the Yanceys and the Rets and stuff, who are the sort of most vocal, but even sort of less well known, state level politicians. The guy in South Carolina is literally named States Rights Gist, is like the governor of South Carolina, or not the governor, but he's the envoy of from South Carolina, who goes out to sort of convince the other states to secede. It's these kind of lower level guys in the South who actually trigger secession. And it's only when Lincoln and the Republicans make it clear that they're not going to compromise on slavery, it's only then that the brain trust itself pulls itself back and says, okay, we're going to support secession. And that's when, South Carolina is a different case. South Carolina was out the door. South Carolina, had one foot out the door since the 1830s. But the other states don't secede until it's clear that compromise fails. So that, Jefferson Davis in Mississippi, Alexander Stevens, who never wanted to go, and Georgia, Judah Benjamin and John Slidell in Louisiana, a lot of these guys who had important national positions, whether, in the U.S. Senate or in the State Department, the War Department, they're not Howell Cobb in Georgia, who was Secretary of the Treasury. They're sticking around in Washington, hoping to figure out a deal where they can still, have access. When it's clear that the Republicans are, there's no deal here, we won the election, we're going to have an anti-slavery administration, that's when they pull out and they say, okay, well, we're going to set up our own regime. And this is the second part of the argument, is that the reason they had the confidence to do that, I mean, because it's a crazy suicidal thing to do. I mean, they ensured their own destruction with this move in 1860, 61. They brought on the Civil War. And, within 4 years, not only was the Confederacy defeated, slavery domestically was destroyed, and slavery internationally, the writing was on the wall. But the reason they had the confidence to pull this off, I think it really does require explanation. A, they were frozen out. They were pushed out of the Union by these Republicans. And B, they really believed that slavery could thrive on the world stage. I mean, this is an important part if we think about the origin of the Confederacy. They really believed that the Confederacy would find allies, maybe not direct military allies, but at least find aid and support, at least acceptance in this sort of international, the arena of nations. And that there was nothing about slavery that prohibited it from joining, prohibited a slaveholding regime from joining the family of nations in the mid-19th century. I mean, and they pointed to all sorts of international phenomena that, from their perspective, showed how compatible slavery was with, global capitalism, with the spread of global empire, with the kind of rising tide of racial science and racial, more aggressive versions of biological racism, for them, their society was compatible with all this. And that, I think, gave them a crucial element of confidence to make what ultimately was a suicidal leap into the abyss with the Confederacy.
Wow, suicidal jump into the abyss. Wow, I thank goodness. Yeah, I definitely that was a great way to present what they did for sure. And so and last part about the Confederacy and the Civil War. What was their foreign policy like? Because I think that's something that I think is valuable for people to know, in that how did the Confederacy, as they were assembled with Jefferson Davis as the president, how do they look outward to get aid in their conflict, right? Because, you know, obviously, you know, wars are a lot of times about alliances. And so how did the Confederacy look out towards the greater European world to gain allies in their struggle for slavery to continue?
Yeah, there are two parts to that I think they're interesting. I mean, one, which kind of trip from the detail that I do for, you know, for the antebellum period, but I think I do sort of use it to think about what it says as a kind of experiment, sort of along the lines of what you were saying earlier about a training ground, that, you know, sort of in reverse, that you can look at the Confederate foreign policy and see a little bit what the late antebellum guys, you know, wanted to do if they had, you know, control of their own state. You know, in effect, they did. It was the United States. But in the Confederacy, they do the same thing. And my argument is, for all the talk about expansion and territorial expansion, they were more interested in the preservation of slavery than in the expansion. I mean, they didn't want to swallow Cuba or northern Mexico and spread slavery if it would endanger the existing slaveholding regime. So they don't want to start, they don't want to get into some kind of conflict with Spain over Cuba. They'd rather sort of make peace with Spain. In fact, say, hey, Spain, you and I, we're both international, you know, we both have an interest in international slavery. Maybe you could sort of, you know, nudge, nudge, wink, wink, you know, allow our blockade runners to, you know, resupply in Havana and so on. And they did. You know, Cuba was definitely a site of Confederate, you know, diplomatic and commercial activity during the war. And in that sense, they were not just mindlessly expansionist. They were strategic, and they were interested in, you know, building alliances with other slaveholding regimes. So, yeah, so Britain and France at this point had abolished slavery. And so they were, you know, obviously Britain was this sort of anti-slavery power. So how are they going to manage that? Their hope was that the evolution of the British economy, of the global economy over the 40s and 50s, had made Britain, you know, even more dependent on slave-produced goods. And Britain was moving in a free trade direction. Britain was moving away from the kind of protectionist policy that it had had dirt when it abolished slavery. It had sort of abandoned the West Indies as a site of sugar production. You know, they could compete with enslaved sugar production. So they thought that, you know, Britain would maybe not welcome them with open arms, but in effect kind of willing to recognize the South and support it because they needed Southern cotton and be willing to support a slave nation because they needed slave produced goods. And in that they really miscalculated. I mean, I think in that sense, British anti-slavery was still, despite being muted from the 1830s, it was stronger than they thought. And B, they weren't as important as they thought they were. You know, this is sort of Sven Beckert's book about how Britain was able to reconstitute, you know, cotton production all around the world, in Brazil, in Egypt, in India, they didn't actually need the slave South to sort of, you know, cotton may have been king, but slavery wasn't emperor, you know, which is how Southerners thought about it. They thought that what was cotton without, what was King Cotton without emperor slavery? You can't, all the other places that have tried to grow cotton without slaves have failed. So nobody can compete with us. Slavery is the true king. That turned out not to be the case. I mean, Britain was able to sort of produce cotton with reasonable degree of efficiency, using other sort of coercive legal measures, using a racialized form of labor, absolutely, in places like India and in Egypt. But it didn't require chattel slavery. It didn't require the ownership of other human beings. And in that sense, you know, slaveholders were, you know, they were wrong about their own capacity on the world stage in a kind of critical way. And they did not receive this sort of support, assistance from Britain that they were counting on. And, you know, in a sense, that doomed their struggle. That's when they landed at the bottom of that abyss in 1865.
Wow. I'm glad that I did ask that final point, because I think that sometimes that people don't really realize, you know, like they may hear about the Confederacy when it comes to, like, you know, they when it comes to their actual domestic policy, And obviously, directly, you know, it's a war administration directly for the 4 years. But also, they're looking out. They're trying to seek, you know, partners to be able to help them. And you know, we were talking about this offline when it came to Sarah Parker Reeman when she's in 1862 in London, you know, speaking to British, you know, folks and folks largely in the convention that she was at, talking about how, well, hey, if y'all are actually supposedly the friends of the Negro, that the best thing you can do is just butt out of the conflict. You're good over here. You know, chill out on the side, grab a spot of tea, and you'll be good. But please do not get into this conflict. And so, you know, she was performing a sort of abolitionist, a black woman abolitionist diplomacy, as I characterize. And so, you know, I think it's very important to bring about, you know, the competing diplomacies, really. And I think one of the things that I enjoyed the most about your book is that, I was never an early Americanist. And to me, early America went all the way up until the Civil War. You know, I know that might not literally be the thing, but in my mind in undergrad, I was like, I don't know, how the hell y'all deal with this like stuff? Like, this is not cool. This is boring as hell. But as typically happens when you say stuff at 18, 19, and 20, when you're 22, 23, 24, and maybe even later in life, you're like, let's scratch that noise. I'm cool in this era. And I can kind of...
Now you're writing about diplomacy in the 1830s. So yeah,
are you
right?
Exactly. So for me, that's why I think this book is so great, because I kind of felt the same way about diplomatic history. I'm like, oh my gosh, like, what do you got? What got to be in like the foreign service or something? Got to be like in the Peace Corps or something like that. But I was like, no, like there's some valuable work that's being conducted that is not simply kind of like, I guess, at least in my novel eyes, like a very kind of boring, kind of very clustered.
Right. I mean, yeah. I think what you're speaking to is what I was saying about, you know, the way in which a certain style of traditional diplomatic history was written that kind of abstracted it from major political ideological issues like slavery. And I think that's true, that some of that older scholarship was written in that vein, and that, you know, there's a reason not to excuse your inexcusable ignorance and youth. But I mean, I think that's a fair point. And what you said about, you know, Sarah Reeman, I mean, that's interesting. I hope we can continue to talk about that later. But the question of pro-slavery and anti-slavery diplomacy and internationalism, that, and also diplomacy that's outside of state governments, right? Like Sarah Reeman is in England lobbying the British government, not as a representative of the U.S. government, but she's still doing diplomacy. And, you know, slaveholders were doing that too, unofficial and official capacities. You know, this is a global struggle, at least a transatlantic struggle, specifically, you know, in the 1860s when it comes to British intervention, you know, in the American Civil War, you know, British abolition, American slavery. Both sides have their European brigades in effect, who are going both officially and unofficially.
Absolutely. And so in the final couple minutes that we have with you today, can you speak to what your because this book completed what, in 2016? I believe 2016, very important with the election. I see what you're doing there.
I don't want you to say, hey, it's been 3 years, Carp. Where's your next book? I would say, no, it hasn't been 2 years, sir. Fall 2016. I beat Trump by 2 months. Yeah.
Oh, wow. Thank God we got one win. And so with that being said, what else are you working on going forward into 2019 and 2020, I suppose?
Yeah, exactly. 2020. We'll see. That would be good. I'm working on it's funny. You talk about anti-slavery diplomacy. I'm working on anti-slavery politics before the Civil War, specifically the Republican Party. I mean, I think what interested me in this moment we were just talking about secession is how kind of unyielding the Republicans were when it came to the things that, you know, these pro-slavery leaders really wanted in terms of pro-slavery foreign policy. And it made me, you know, kind of want to go back and, you know, give the Republican Party another look. you know, as a party that I think in a lot of ways was a lot more revolutionary, a lot more radical than we're inclined to give it credit, because they weren't, you know, they weren't the kind of most aggressive abolitionists in the Union at the time in the 1850s. But nevertheless, they represented a really fundamental change in the American political system that I think a lot of abolitionists actually recognized was going to shake the system up. People like Frederick Douglass, people like, even abolitionists who are hostile to party politics, like Wendell Phillips, sort of recognized that the Republican Party was a game changer in American politics. And I'm interested in how anti-slavery sort of went from a radical fringe, from the sort of far margins of American political life, which is really where it was for the first, 50 years of the American Republic, to first 50, 60 years, to really taking, informing, having significant influence over the federal government in, a handful of years in the 1850s. So that's the next book. It's obviously a big one. It's more, I think, domestic than the first book. It's more about, what was going on in the United States in the political struggle over slavery. But I mean, for African American studies listeners, I mean, I think one element that I'm really interested in uncovering is the amount of the degree to which Republicans actually before the war gained support from African American abolitionists, and that there were, we think about Black Republicans in Reconstruction, you had dozens of Black, congressmen, senators, governors, state legislators, hundreds, really. But there were Black Republicans before the war, too. I mean, Douglass was one of them. He was ambivalent about the party, but he supported it. There were a lot of other ones, John Mercer Langston in Ohio, his brother Charles Mercer Langston, William Nell gave the party a lot of support. The degree to which African Americans themselves mobilized behind the Republican Party, I think, has been forgotten to an extent in the literature. So I'm still at the beginning of this project, but that's an aspect that I'm interested in pursuing.
Well, hey, I will definitely be happy to speak to you on that particular project, especially because a lot of our interests historically are very much aligned. And so I guess I will take on the onus of the foreign policy, and I'll return you the domestic with this.
Okay, yeah, exactly. I'll pick your brain on the domestic. Yeah, absolutely.
Lord knows, I'll pick your brain on the foreign policy aspect. And so with that being said, is there a way that scholars and other listeners to the podcast can get in touch with you to maybe ask you some questions about the book and other aspects of your career?
I mean, I am on Twitter, although I've been kind of in a dark mode the past year as I struggle to get this tenure file in. It's hard to write a book and tweet at the same time. I found that really hard. It's easy to promote a book and tweet, but it's harder to write a book and tweet. So, it's been a struggle. So I kind of went off, although I still check the account. So, people message me there, but also, my email, my university email is, mjcarp@princeton. And I'd be happy to hear from listeners.
Very good. And so with that being said, Dr. Karp, we definitely appreciate your time. And once again, we've had the opportunity to chat with Assistant Professor of History at Princeton University, Matthew Karp, for his book published in 2016 through Harvard University Press, entitled This Vast Southern Empire, Slaveholders at the Helm of American Foreign Policy. And once again, thank you for your time. And we'll definitely talk to you maybe even in 2020 with another election coming
up. We'll see. We can get Kanye in next time. Yeah.
Hey, Kanye 2020 or 2020.
Exactly.
All righty. Until next time, New Books in African American Studies listeners, this is your host, Adam McNeil. Until next time.